Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This week marks the 6th anniversary of the Indian Ocean tsunami that killed more than 200,000 people. It's still unimaginable. How do people ever recover from witnessing such an unthinkable thing? Well, in addition to donating food, medicine, money, the U.S. often sends mental health counselors following a disaster. But is this always a good idea? Journalist Ethan Waters explores this question in his book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. He says that however well-intentioned, the U.S. is exporting thinking about mental health, and in doing so may actually be spreading illness. Sometimes it's indirect. For example, young girls in Hong Kong occasionally used to express feelings of sadness or anger by not eating. But after learning about America's anorexia, suddenly girls in Hong Kong began starving themselves to be thin. And sometimes the spread is pointed, like GlaxoSmithKline's campaign to sell the Japanese on the idea of depression in order to sell them antidepressants like Paxil. Well, today we want to revisit our conversation with Ethan Waters and start with anorexia in Hong Kong. He profiled Sing Lee, an eating disorder expert who worked with patients before the American concept of this disorder was introduced.
There was a form of anorexia in Hong Kong in the late 80s and early 90s. It was a very rare disorder, and it didn't look like the American form. It didn't have fat phobia. It didn't have body dysmorphia. It wasn't related to dieting or weight loss. Suddenly, in 1994, a young woman died on the streets of downtown Hong Kong, clearly anorexic. And suddenly the press had to explain what had happened to this young woman. And basically what they did was that they imported the American idea. They went to American experts, American diagnostic manuals to explain to the Hong Kong public what was this strange disease, who was at risk, what did it mean, what were its causes. After 1994, you saw a rise of the disorder. And not only a rise of the disorder, but a change of form in the disorder. Suddenly it looked more like the American diagnosis of anorexia with all its attendant criteria. So the fear is that we not only export something like anorexia to another culture in terms of our pop culture notions about weight and fashions and so forth, but that the very idea of anorexia itself, when it crosses borders, can become part of the symptom pool of another culture.
The symptom pool, that's part of your theory. It's almost the reverse of what we tend to think. The symptoms are out there, and people can take them on to sort of allow them an opportunity to go through whatever feelings they have. As opposed to, you know, the way we think of it is that the symptoms arise and then you try to find out where the symptoms came from. Are they related to feelings?
That's right. This is much easier to see when you look across time, for instance. So you look, say, to Victorian era Europe and you see thousands of women manifesting the very remarkable symptoms of hysteria, including things like hysterical leg paralysis. This is not a matter of those women faking their disorder, but it is a matter of their unconscious minds latching on to the language of suffering for that time period. This is culture talking to the unconscious mind. So mental illnesses are real, but they're attached to cultural expressions of them. And the other way to see this, of course, is once you look across culture, you can look to Southeastern Asian males and look at a disorder called Koro, which is this debilitating belief that your genitals are retracting into your body and going
yes.
to cause your death.
Yeah.
Or something like a muck, a mental illness sparked by a moment of social distress or a social insult, followed by a period of brooding, followed by a murderous rage, followed by amnesia. These are all cultural expressions of mental illness. And for some reason, I think in America, we think that we've gotten beyond the culture of mental illnesses, that we've finally arrived at the true scientific expression of PTSD or depression or something like that. But in fact, there is no way to disconnect culture from mental illness. It will always be shaping our expression. That mind always looks to the culture around it to try to understand what's happening to it, what's going to happen next, what's the likely outcome of these things. And indeed, the people around the mentally ill person do the same thing. And those two forces are very powerful in shaping how a mental illness will eventually express itself and resolve itself.
Let's go back to the young girl in Hong Kong who died and brought anorexia really to the fore. And then, as you say, people started looking to the West for explanations. What would be an explanation for anorexia, if not a concern about weight and eating and your looks?
Well, Sing Lee was trying to answer that question when he was studying those pre-1994 anorexics. You know, they would explain their symptoms in terms of somatic symptoms. They would say, I have a blockage in my throat. The food will not go down. I'm hungry, but I cannot eat, or my stomach is bloated. And it was tied up in psychological family distress often. You know, the Chinese have a very layered and interesting sort of relationship with food. They have their own religious notions that played into this, notions of aestheticism. It had its own cultural meanings and forces. You know, before 1994, after that, it much more shaped itself into an American version. And it's not that in 1994, America suddenly was, or the West was suddenly a presence in Hong Kong. Of course, this was, at the time, a British province. This was a cosmopolitan city. And if you remember also, that was a very nervous time for Hong Kong. This was after Tiananmen Square had happened, but before the handover of sovereignty to the Chinese. There was lots of psychic distress at that time in the population. Into that population suddenly came a notion that one of the ways to express this internal distress is through restricting your eating.
So, Ethan Waters, what are you saying? Are you saying that what many people would say would be well-intended education about something like anorexia or bulimia, to let young people know that it's possible to watch out for it, is actually acting like a virus? That's and right. They're catching it?
Exactly, that there is a social contagious aspect to this. And if you ask any eating disorder specialist who does education, they will say, when we go in front of a classroom or in front of a school, we know this is a possibility, and we're very careful not to do a number of things. We're very careful not to put the eating disorder sufferer on the stage. We know never to talk about the celebrity that has it. But when you look to the media in the United States, or the media that happened after that one death in downtown Hong Kong, we do the exact opposite. We always feature the dramatic story. We always feature the celebrity. So it's not necessarily the mental health professionals, but it's how these things play out into popular culture, oftentimes through journalists who are eager for the next syndrome. We love the story of the next syndrome. But in telling the story of the next syndrome, we are part of a process by which these symptoms in our symptom pool change over time.
We're revisiting our conversation with Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. It's about how American help for people who've been through disasters can often have unintended consequences. For example, take Sri Lanka after that 2004 tsunami 6 years ago this week. After the tsunami, there was an influx of psychological counselors, and Ethan talked to many of them and found that well-intentioned people who went to help people they presumed would have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, found that in many cases they did more harm than good.
We went in with this assumption that we knew that PTSD is a universal thing. But they're actually, you know, the anthropologists know that the reactions to trauma actually do differ across cultures. Meaning matters a great deal. What you think of the event, what you predict your symptoms will be. And it often comes down to really fundamental notions and differences in how you think about the human mind. In America, we think of ourselves as really individualistic, and the mind as being the place that the trauma occurs. And if you ask an American who is suffering from PTSD where their trauma was, they would point to their head. It's in their head. Anthropologists who study people in Sri Lanka, for instance, know that when you ask a Sri Lankan where does the trauma exist, they'll point to their social circle. They'll say, it is in my inability to fulfill my social role, for instance, or it's in the breakages in my social circle. So it's a different sense of where the self resides.
Well, in fact, when you take people out away from their social circles and bring them to special places where they can be worked with by Western psychologists to get over their trauma, then you're then increasing it.
Well, exactly. So for an American to take time away from their social circle to heal makes perfect sense because it matches our understanding of the mind. For a Sri Lankan to do the same thing, to take time away from their social role to heal, suddenly that is the exact problem they're describing. And neither one of those conceptions are right, but when we rush into another culture with our American notion of PTSD, we often disconnect the hurt individual from their local conceptions of the self, but also from their local conceptions for how to get better, how to heal. You know, I followed an anthropologist all the way down to Zanzibar, who was studying how spirit possession notions are wrapped up with their view of schizophrenia. So spirit possession notions are very alive and well in places like Zanzibar. And we as Americans would think that that would be a terribly stigmatizing thing. Well, what you find when you go down to a place like that is that spirit possession notions are often used to keep the ill person within the group. It's not thing that ostracizes the person. It keeps them within the group. It provides modes and methods of interacting with the ill person that are actually extremely valuable and helpful and filled with kindness and concern. So our idea that it's better to think about mental illnesses in terms of a biomedical idea, that this will reduce stigma, actually, when you study that around the world, it turns out not to be the case. In fact, people that adopt the biomedical notion of mental illness, as true as it might be, are also the people that are likely to believe that the ill person is more unpredictable, more dangerous. They want more social distance from that person.
Perhaps the most explosive story you tell is the one about American big pharma selling the idea of mental health in order to sell drugs. That brings us to Japan and GlaxoSmithKline, which wanted to market antidepressants in Japan. But Japan wasn't a big market for antidepressants because, to begin with, they had no real, even analogous condition to what Americans might describe as depression.
That's right. Big Pharma knew that Japan didn't have a category for depression. They had an idea, a clinical idea of depression, but it was really described a very severe and very rare illness in Japan. And that's not to say that Japan didn't have other forms of sadness. They were just put in different cultural boxes. You can make the case, and anthropologists have, that Japan is indeed a very sad culture, that it embraces the experience of sadness as almost a transcendent state, something you could learn from.
And even when we think of suicides in Japan, suicide is had a very different meaning in Japan.
It did. For an American to think of a suicide, you would almost certainly think, well, this person was depressed or mentally ill. But in Japan, the suicide had a much different history. They called them, you know, suicides of resolve, where it was done for reasons of shame or for reasons of honor. And there was really not the sense that suicide was necessarily connected to a mental illness like depression. That's not to say that American conceptions of depression, when applied to notions of suicide in Japan, might not actually be helpful. I mean, one thing, to GlaxoSmithKline's credit, after the introduction of Paxil in Japan, suicide rates have indeed fallen in Japan.
But depression rates have shot up.
But a huge swath of the population now once believed that they were melancholy or sad, now believe that they're mentally ill.
Well, and you speak to many scientists, researchers, doctors who were involved in GlaxoSmithKline's push to achieve this. And they say right up front, they felt that the people at the drug company honestly believed that they had salvation for Japan. But how they went about it, they took out advertising, sort of trying to get the word out that there's such a thing as depression. Tell us some of the other ways that they set the groundwork for people wanting the drug.
They did web-based marketing. They co-opted celebrities in this push. They paid huge amounts of money to very prominent members of the mental health profession in Japan.
Came up with a phrase to describe.
Oh, and they came up with a lovely phrase because, you know, they wanted to counteract this idea that Japan thought of depression as being a severe mental illness. So the phrase that they came up with was that depression was a cold of the soul. So it's no big deal. You take a medication for a cold. You should take a medication when you're depressed. And the Japanese really responded to this over time. And many of the mental health professionals in Japan who were co-opted into this promotion have now, many of them had deep second thoughts.
I can hear people saying, well, wait a second. Antidepressants saved my life here in America. They made it possible for me to function.
That's right.
Why shouldn't the Japanese have that as well?
It's a good argument. We do have advances. My wife is a psychiatrist. She prescribes these drugs. I'm not against quality drugs and sharing them with the rest of the world. We should be sharing our notions of our knowledge of the mind with the rest of the world. But we have to be careful as we do that not to trample upon local notions of the mind that may themselves be very valuable when it comes to, you know, to attaining mental health. We cannot stop globalization. You cannot redraw those boundaries. But at least we could hope that the interchange of ideas about how to achieve mental health are not simply west to east, rich to poor, but that actually go both ways.
That's Ethan Waters. His book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. We spoke last February.